good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 549 of Unwelcome Guests, Human Casualties, The Chemical Civil War. I'm Robin Upton. Following on from last week's show on the dangers of ionizing radiation, we're looking this week at chemical dangers. Just as we saw last week, the safe limits of radiation exposure may in fact be orders of magnitude more dangerous than admitted by government or by industry, we shall see some evidence that the same is true of chemical pollution. This takes different forms. In the first world, this is generally covert and stealthy and could be attributed to lack of applying the precautionary principle. With a lot of new chemicals being created, it's very hard, perhaps impossible, to assess the long-term health impacts of those chemicals, and that is used by those who create them as some kind of justification for not a failure to assess their health impact, but the assumption that they're in fact not dangerous. As we shall see, it's the interaction between these chemicals which is perhaps the largest unknown and perhaps the most dangerous. We're going to contrast this with the damage to the so-called poor countries, what used to be safely away from the awareness of those in the first world, whose corporations are the most active in despoiling and destroying the natural abundance that exists there. That's going to be a radio adaptation of a film called Poison Fire about gas flaring in Nigeria, and we're going to conclude the show with a professor speaking about fetal damage from environmental toxins. But let's start with a radio adaptation of Carol Polykin's 2007 film Homo Toxicus.
Every day, massive amounts of chemicals are released into the environment, in the air, in the water, and in many of the products we use in our homes. When a filmmaker decides to have her own blood tested, she learns that there are 110 contaminants in her body.
Aldrin, chloridane, Myrix, hexachlorobenzene.
Is this normal or a cause for concern?
One of the compounds that has me most concerned is a plastic molecule called bisphenol A.
Carol Polykin sets out to find if toxic substances in our bodies could be causing an increase in health problems.
It's impossible to escape this insidious pollution.
That's Homo Toxicus, Toxic Man.
One day, our ancestor, Homo erectus, discovered fire.
Huh? Well, what do you know? Fire! Hmm.
Ingeniously, he used it for light. For heat. And for barbecue chicken.
Yum!
The news spread quickly. Soon we were baking clay, smelting ore. Humankind had fearlessly embarked on the road to progress. Today, thanks to human ingenuity, over 100,000 new chemicals synthesized in laboratories fashion the world we live in. We've introduced these amazing molecules into our environment without really considering whether nature would be able to recognize them and break them down. In our short-sighted rush to progress, we never imagined that some of these molecules would one day work their way into living organisms.
J'ai ici les tubes de sang de cordon.
These test tubes contain umbilical cord blood. We've analyzed thousands of them and found pollutants such as heavy metals, organochlorine pesticides, PCBs, and that means that the mother was exposed to these pollutants and transmitted them through her bloodstream to her unborn child.
Progress is merciless. After Homo erectus and Homo sapiens, we now have Homo toxicus. As a representative of this new species, I decided to sacrifice a few drops of my blood for science. I'm no hypochondriac, but there has yet to be an exhaustive study on chemical contamination of the Canadian population. I'm lucky to live in a pleasant city not yet touched by major air pollution. The Beauce region, where I grew up, was rural, even bucolic. In any case, it's certainly not where the word pollution was first coined. Unless I'm mistaken, my toxic report shouldn't be too catastrophic.
If we start with heavy metals, we've detected about 20 heavy metals in your blood. The levels are generally within normal range. The only element that's a little over is mercury. Nothing to worry about according to the standards. For PCBs, your total is just slightly above the norm. Erythroids at 2 is higher than most
people.
Here we see your level of phthalates, a high concentration of this pesticide. With this level of PBDEs, we can't say. We have no evidence that they don't have any effects, yet we certainly don't have any evidence that they do.
Lead, manganese, tin, brominated flame retardants, beryllium, cadmium, arsenic, non-stick perfluorocarbons, aldrin, chlordane, myrix, hexachlorobenzene, phthalates, dioxins, and even DDT, a pesticide that's been banned for more than 30 years. For over an hour, Dr. Weber listed and explained the 110 contaminants found in my blood.
We're exposed to all kinds of environmental pollutants, and the body has gotten used to defending itself against them. So we can be exposed to small amounts without being affected. The basic principle of toxicology is that it's the dose that makes the poison.
So I'm exposed, but I shouldn't worry.
Exactly.
It's reassuring to know that I have normal levels of toxic substances in my bloodstream. But I mustn't complain. At a time of such prosperity, I'm not going to grumble over a few micrograms of phthalates. In North America, 4 million tons of chemical substances are emitted into the environment each year. That's the price we pay to produce and destroy everything we consume. And that's not factoring in transport or pesticides. Obeying the immutable laws of gravity, these particles fall back to Earth and into the water, where they disperse and are absorbed by fish, to end up on my plate. We know very little what effect all these substances can have when put together. Well, that's just it. I've got phthalates, bisphenol A, heavy metals, all that, all together. That's not something I should start worrying about?
Are you ill?
No, I'm well. I don't have any health problems.
Well, precisely. Therein lies the problem. What happens with these substances is that we can only see their effects on large populations. Their levels aren't high enough to make people sick. There are studies that show that, for example, there's a connection between PCB concentrations in the blood and thyroid hormone secretions. And that's important information, because we know that the number of people with thyroid problems is increasing. I said I wasn't ill, but I have had thyroid problems that have come and gone. Could there be a connection? We'll never know. With individuals, it's very difficult to make a connection because individual illnesses do not have a single cause. Our children are born in comfort and abundance. And it's to protect them from the risks of fire that we force the manufacturers to coat their sleepwear with flame retardants, such as PBDEs. This chemical is also present in stuffed animals, as well as couches and computers. Now, from regular everyday use, these molecules leach out of the items and enter the environment. Over the last 25 years, concentrations of PBDEs in mother's milk have multiplied 100-fold. Even though we're still dealing with trace amounts, the concentrations in breast milk are now doubling every 5 years. In our day-to-day lives, our exposure to toxic chemicals is in the billionth or even trillionth of a gram range, the equivalent of a few grains of sand tossed into an Olympic swimming pool. Yet we're now beginning to understand that even these amounts alter our biological processes.
John Peterson Myers, co-author of Our Stolen Future.
Toxicology, for a long time, the study of toxicology has focused on what do high levels do, what do high exposure levels do. And just about everyone agrees that high exposure levels cause problems of a lot of things. But toxicologists have been blind to the fact that some contaminants alter gene expression at really low levels. Genes are turned on and off throughout life. There's a symphony of genes turning on and off, on and off, on and off, and partway on, partway off. And they're sending signals to one another, and they're making proteins that we need to be healthy. And what we've learned, the core, the essence of this science, is that low levels of contamination can alter the ways that genes behave. One of the compounds that has me most concerned is a plastic molecule called bisphenol A. This molecule is able to change cell signaling at the lowest levels that have ever been tested, 0.23 parts per trillion. At that level, it changes cell signaling. At a little bit higher level, it increases the risk to breast cancer in rats and mice. At a little bit higher level, it causes prostate cancer in rats. At somewhat higher level, it causes insulin resistance in mice. Insulin resistance is linked to obesity and diabetes. The US EPA standard right now for exposure, accepted safe level exposure, is 50 parts per billion. Based on experiments done in the 1980s, the scientific Jurassic, that involved testing whether a rodent would lose weight when exposed to high levels of bisphenol A. They found that at 50 parts per million, it lost weight. And they said, oh, we don't have to test any lower. We'll use some safety factors, 1,000-fold, and we'll say, and we'll never test it at that level, but we'll just say that's safe. So that's the current health standard, despite the fact that in the last 7 years, there have been over 150 studies by academic scientists saying that bisphenol A causes health problems. Now, coincidentally, there have been 12 studies funded by industry of the same thing, and none of them have found health problems at those exposure levels.
It's impossible to escape this insidious pollution. There's bisphenol A in my water bottle, in baby bottles, and in the lining of canned foods. PBDEs leach out of my computer and other electronic devices. I inhale them every day along with phthalates from vinyl and soft plastics that some toys are made of and can be toxic for reproduction. PFOAs found in stain repellents and in my nonstick cookware have been linked to thyroid problems and cancer. So it's even seeping out of the pink Teflon frying pan I specifically bought to support breast cancer research. My household cleaners contained glycol ethers and nonylphenols. And that's not to mention parabens, a preservative that mimics estrogen, found in my shampoo, my sunscreen, my day cream, and my night cream. Canada has approved the use of 6 hormones in order to increase the competitiveness of beef, and of course beef producers. According to Health Canada, hormone residues in beef are so minimal that their consumption is harmless. But that opinion isn't shared by the European Union, which has banned the hormones since 1988, concluding that it was impossible to determine a safe level. The United States and Canada undertook proceedings against the European Union, accusing them of erecting unnecessary barriers to trade. Dr. Henrik Luffers, a Danish scientist, is part of the committee that put together evidence to support the EU's position.
The estrogen level in prepubertal children is so low that it cannot be measured. The technology we have for measuring hormones, we cannot measure it. But we know that the child's growth is dependent on those hormones that are present below detection limit. So when you add more hormones, for instance from beef, there will be an additive effect. There cannot be a threshold or any security level. It will immediately add to what's in there already. So in principle, this should give a higher risk. It has not been proven that there is a higher risk, but we have considerably more breast cancer in the US than in Europe. So whether it's caused by these hormones, I don't know, and nobody knows. But I can't see any reason why we should expose the whole population to hormones that we know in animal experiments are bad.
I don't have to worry about hormones, since I hardly consume any beef. But my numerous vegetarian meals, that aren't always organic, offer me a slew of herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides used in agriculture. In the interests of productivity, eating has become a risky business.
O'Neill Samuel, Quebec National Public Health Institute, Human Toxicology Technical Advisor.
In our study on children, we observed, particularly for organophosphoric insecticides, that all of the children had been exposed. 99% of the children had been exposed to that group of insecticides. And not only had they been exposed, but they had been exposed at higher levels than what we find in the scientific literature. There have been large studies done, particularly in the United States, Italy, and other European countries, and our children were almost always found to have much higher exposure than those in the other studies. It's possible that our children consume more fruits and vegetables than American children. It's a hypothesis, which has not yet been validated. The second hypothesis is that our fruits and vegetables possibly contain more pesticides.
Could it be that because our standards are less stringent, our children are more exposed? Compared to Europe, Canada permits twice as much thurium on tomatoes, 4 times as much carbofuran on strawberries, 400 times as much permethrin on certain leafy vegetables, and 1,400 times as much methoxychlor on its fruits and vegetables.
All in all, we're talking about low levels of exposure, but with all the uncertainties associated with this, we must be very cautious. Recently, for instance, medical journals have reported neurotoxic effects even at very low concentrations. So the fact that some types of learning could be slowed down with low-dose exposure over long periods worries us and leads us to seek ways to diminish the use of these products and, most importantly, to reduce the residues found in food.
A few years ago, for the good of our children, Quebec banned the use of pesticides for aesthetic reasons, despite manufacturers' threats to sue. The same well-intentioned logic should be used to ban pesticides from agriculture as well. Except that all our agriculture relies on these pesticides. Banning them would mean changing our way of doing things. And we are far from that. The need for maximum productivity is stronger than ever and often comes with a heavy environmental price. Like in Chemical Valley in Sarnia. Here we find, squeezed into a few kilometers, a high concentration of refineries and chemical plants, a coal-fired power plant, and a toxic waste dump. A model of economic development, or an environmental sacrifice zone. We should ask the citizens of Amjonang, an Indian reservation in the heart of this colossal industrial complex.
I also have to give my daughter her puffer before she goes. It's 5 minutes apart, and we only did the blue one so far, so...
Which one has a puffer? It's a problem here in the reserve?
Yes. Yeah, all my kids have had been on this at one point or another. My two older ones used to be always on it, too, but they've kind of outgrown it. Their lungs have matured more, so they're able to handle it more. So.
She's allergic with the mosquitoes, that I have to take that there. And just, yeah. Actually, I don't think I signed a note. I just handed it to the teacher. She gets bit and starts swelling up, give it to her. But it's got to be prescribed, though.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, one of the daycare teachers were saying that there's a whole bunch of kids that are all allergic to the mosquito bites.
Maybe you noticed. Only one boy got on the bus. And it's pretty much the same at all the other bus stops. An unusual phenomenon has been affecting the community since 1993. Male births have been in decline. It's gotten to the point where today in Amjonang, twice as many girls are born as boys.
Thank you.
So you're lucky that you had a boy.
Yeah.
And do you know now if you have a boy or a girl?
The ultrasound said it's a girl, but my husband Ron still says it's a boy. So it's still up in the air.
Okay,
it wasn't inconclusive that it was a girl. It's just strong evidence towards a girl.
He is your first baby?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've had a few miscarriages before.
Oh, you too?
And then one afterwards, like one just before this one, we had a miscarriage.
How many?
In total, 4 miscarriages. When I got pregnant with Miskwa, our main worries that we wouldn't be able to carry him to term. So when we reached the 3-month mark with him, it was a major milestone.
Wow.
And then to find out that he was a boy was like the best thing ever. I grew up here my whole life, and their flares at night were our nightlights. We'd get calls at 3 o'clock in the morning to say evacuate kind of thing. And we've been like this our whole life.
Holy. 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 Chemical Valley.
Two of the residents have made exhaustive-looking maps of people with coloured dots to indicate different types of afflictions in juveniles and in adults.
No, because we put it as a boy and a girl. So that's the female child under the age of 16. Orange ones are breathing problems, bloody noses and sore throats. The blue, this was interesting too, because that can mean like, but that's hearing problems or ear problems, vision loss, learning or development problems, behavioral problems, ADHD and stuff. This is the male child.
Wow.
And these are your learning disabilities again, right?
All those orange
Those are the orange are the breathing problems, respiratory problems and stuff. It's from your smoking and your drinking and your alcohol, drugs. That's why all this is happening to us.
That's what
they keep saying. This is the female adult. And these are the miscarriages and stuff, too. Oh, sorry.
Miscarriages.
Yeah. It just hurts to see all of this stuff. You know, me and Naomi Oliver, we did this, right? We did the surveys. We checked off who's going to get what dot and stuff like that, right? And she entered it into the computer. And then I'd put the dots on. We worked together all the time. And then at the end of the day, we'd just sit there and stare at it. And then, you know, we could feel the lumps in our throats, the tears in our eyes. But then, you know, we just carried on to get it done, you know, do it, just get it done. And then we had to take off like a week or two just to get away from it. And, you know, people always ask me all the time, you know, want me to recite all this stuff. But it's hard because you learn this stuff, but if you keep thinking about it all the time, you're gonna, you know, hurt yourself inside too, so you gotta walk away from it for a while. I gotta go blow my nose, sorry.
Shanna Swan, Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, University of Rochester, New York.
Sex ratio is a very, very important endpoint. You know, it stands for, as a marker for other problems. It's not going to be in isolation. You don't have an altered sex ratio in isolation.
Right. Usual figures are 106 males for every 100 females. So slightly more males than females. However, before birth, there are even more males, and they are lost through miscarriage and stillbirth at a higher rate than the females. And this continues. So at some point, there's an equal number of males and females in the population, and then eventually there's many more females. But this shouldn't happen at birth, because we need that reserve of males to be around because of this excess morbidity to males throughout life.
One plausible hypothesis to explain this disturbing shortage of boys would be that since 1993, something has been making male fetuses even more fragile. They can't make it to full term.
James Brophy, Director of the Occupational Health Clinic for Ontario Workers.
Something started in 1993. Did it happen then? Or did it happen earlier and the children were exposed, and then as adults something begins to happen? Was it a new process that was entered into in the Chemical Valley? Was there, for instance, one new plant or one new product being produced, and then that added into the mixture? I mean, we truthfully don't know what triggered this.
Industry officials were unavailable for comment during both my visits to Sarnia. The sex ratio has begun to drop in industrialized countries. A subtle yet noticeable decline. Could the hundreds of endocrine disruptors present in our environment explain this disturbance in human reproduction? Looking for clues, biologists around the world closely observe wildlife. Like this research team I'm accompanying on the St. Lawrence River, not far from where the entire city's industrial and domestic sewage is dumped.
Daniel Sire, Professor of Toxicology, Institut Armand Frappier.
The St. Lawrence is a pollution smorgasbord. There are thousands of pollutants here, and we know that in this particular area, we find pollutants that act like estrogens. They're called xenoestrogens, particularly nonyl phenols, a common detergent that is estrogenic. What we notice is that the more exposure to estrogenic products, the lower the spermatogenesis, meaning that the fish produce less sperm, and that the sperm that is produced is less active. They swim less. That's important in fish, because the sperm is active for only about 30 seconds. Thus, if they're slower, they're active for less time. The chances of fertilization decrease significantly. Moreover, another thing we found is that together with this decrease of spermatogenesis, this increase of estrogenic pollutants, we found many hermaphrodite fish, meaning ovaries are beginning to grow in their testicles. So instead of producing sperm, they're producing eggs.
This same concern is what has brought another group of researchers to the Barbou River, a tributary of the Yamaska River, whose waters are so polluted that frogs are scarce. This river runs through a region of corn and soy fields, stretching as far as the eye can see. The presence in the water of atrazine, the herbicide most widely used on corn, is suspected of affecting the batrachians' reproductive system, which could in part explain their declining population.
Sylvia Ruby, Professor of Biology, Concordia University.
What we did when we came on the Yamaska River was to collect the tadpoles at the time of the year when the testis was developing, and we measured in the water over 65 pesticides, herbicides, and the only one that showed up with a direct correlation between degenerating testis and the levels of pesticide or herbicide was the atrazine, and it gave us a very, very high correlation.
Could these small quantities affect humans?
He gave you the answer.
The bullfrog?
Yes. He says absolutely yes. I think the value with working with hormones is that through evolution, they've been very faithfully conserved. So estrogen in lower forms is the same as estrogen in higher forms, and the receptor sites on which they act. And so there is a potential there to be able to extrapolate.
Feminized fish? Infertile frogs whose hormones resemble mine? Health Canada must be really worried.
John Wargon, Pest Management Regulatory Agency, Health Canada.
La grenouille n'est pas un bon modèle.
The frog is not a good model for assessing the risk to man. First of all, it's not a mammal, it's a frog. Secondly, they live in the water. We don't live in the water, madam. We live on land. Thirdly, they breathe through their skin. So you see, it's not a good model for estimating what the risk to man will be. It's unquestionably a model for estimating the risk to amphibians.
That's reassuring. But not entirely. True, I don't live in pesticide-ridden water, but I do drink it.
We wondered whether the sperm count was different in different places in the United States. And what we found was that it was poorer. Sperm quality was poorer, not as good, in the rural agricultural community of Columbia, Missouri, compared to the urban big city communities in Los Angeles, New York City, and Minneapolis. And so the first thing that jumps out at you when you see that difference is maybe it's a pesticide. So to look at that, we went to our Missouri population and we looked to see whether men who had low sperm concentration had higher levels of pesticides than men with high sperm concentration. And that was what we found. That was also very surprising.
Europe has banned the pesticide atrazine while it remains in use in Canada and the United States.
The decision in Europe was based on a policy they have. It wasn't based on a risk analysis, it wasn't based on science, and it wasn't based on atrazine. They have a policy that prohibits concentrations of any chemical in groundwater from exceeding 0.1 part per billion.
And that policy, is it the precautionary principle?
We have a precautionary approach in Canada, too. And if we determine that there's an imminent risk to health or to the environment, we take the necessary measures to remedy the situation. That's what we've done in the past. And in the case of atrazine, it wasn't a question of imminent risk, but we reduced the application rates. We have mitigation measures that minimize the associated risk to the environment and human health.
Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry Congress in Montreal.
What we've shown in the lab is that at 21 micrograms per liter, we see degenerating testis with atrazine. Right. It's often very uncomfortable to speak out about atrazine because of the economic issues and monies involved and so on. But still, as a scientist, there comes a point in your life where you feel that you have to speak out and say, yes, the weight of evidence has tipped in the direction that atrazine, we should be thinking very closely about removing atrazine.
We're not all equal when it comes to environmental factors. Some men naturally produce less sperm than others. They're the ones most at risk of falling below the fertility threshold if there's a general decrease in sperm production. Some studies put this decrease at 2% a year since the 1970s. Worrisome numbers that have confounded many skeptics,
Jacques Augier, Center for the Study of Conservation of Human Ova and Sperm in Paris.
If we expose rats from conception, that is, in the womb, until adulthood, to doses equivalent to what humans are exposed to, we find a lot of adverse effects. Malformations, undescended testicles, low sperm count, low fertility, altered sexual behavior, etc., etc. Obviously, this raises some major questions with regard to humans.
We'll never have absolute proof without using human test subjects. But more and more studies are leading toward the same conclusion. Studies on laboratory animals, on human cells, and epidemiological studies, which look at populations. We've played with fire and turned ourselves into guinea pigs. Through thoughtlessness or greed, could we now be crossing the line between progress and self-destruction? We didn't know any better. Fire fulfilled its promise of progress, and we thought that the earth and its oceans were limitless, able to absorb all our waste. Now, that waste has found its way inside us.
I had my own blood tested, and we found 110 chemicals. So shouldn't I be worried about that?
Karen Lloyd, Director for the Bureau of Risk and Impact Assessment, Health Canada.
I don't think so for the most part. For most of the chemicals that Canadians are exposed to, we have a comprehensive set of laws in Canada that help us identify the chemicals are of concern and to take the controls to manage them. There's a variety of laws that they depend on the type of chemical that we want to assess and to manage the risk from. So you'll probably be talking to someone on pesticides, and that's the Pest Control Products Act. And then there's an act that deals with drugs and with cosmetics and veterinary drugs. And the most comprehensive act, of course, is the Canadian Environmental Protection Act, which is the one that I deal with. And that gives the federal government the authority to require information from industry so that we can assess the risk of the chemicals and then to manage the risk in whichever way we think is appropriate.
Did you think that Health Canada's role was to protect your health through a precautionary approach? Well, think again. Today, it's all about risk management and evaluating what constitutes an acceptable risk. This approach clearly demonstrates how Health Canada's mandate has been eroding since the implementation of smart regulation a few years ago.
Bruce Campbell, Director for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives.
The precautionary approach, the philosophy is protection first, primacy of protection. The smart regulation approach takes the criteria is risk management. What we're talking about is a long-standing initiative of deregulation. It's corporate-driven. It's supported by business think tanks. And what is different about the risk management approach is that it elevates economic competitiveness considerations to the same level as questions of health and safety and protection. So basically it says, you know, you have to, you know, if you're going to, you know, regulate us in a certain way, you have to give equal weight to these to our concerns about competition and cost.
It's perhaps with that in mind that in 2006, Canada courageously banned the use of 4-PBDEs, which the industry had already taken off the market. For the most widely used PBDE on the market, Health Canada relies on the industry to take voluntary measures and for consumers to beware. I was careful to keep a sample of my blood plasma as evidence. I wanted to present it to the chemical companies and give them back a few of their molecules. An unusual and somewhat intimidating mission.
Is it normal that we have so many chemicals in our bodies now?
Gordon Lloyd, VP Technical Affairs for the Canadian Chemical Producers Association.
Well, I think that's something we need to get better information on. One of the things Canadian Chemical Producers Association has done is we very much supported Health Canada's efforts to try to have a broad biomonitoring program of chemicals so that we can get a broad sample. I mean, what's in your blood is obviously important to you. But up to now, we have done samples of very few people. And we need to do a much broader sampling. We need to get an understanding of what is in people's blood. That will help industry in terms of prioritizing what we need to work on in terms of reducing our contribution to that.
The industry spokesman fulfilled his role well. He stressed the voluntary environmental measures taken by manufacturers. He confirmed their willingness to cooperate with Canada's new Substances Evaluation Program and ensured that past mistakes won't be repeated. But banning toxic substances?
The industry's position is always, let's do more studies. How much evidence do we need to ban a product?
Banning is a very legitimate risk management tool, but it's not the only risk management tool. The essence of risk managing, if you can limit the exposure and manage the exposure, then you have achieved the result.
I wanted to give you that as a reminder. This is a little bit of my plasma.
Okay. Well, look, we'll make a trade. I'll give you our book about reducing emissions, and I'll yours is a more personal one.
The scene shifts to an outside stall entitled Toxic Buffet, with activists regaling bemused-looking passers-by on the street.
Would you like something to eat? Some hormones, some antibiotics, or perhaps some pesticides?
You have a choice of salmon with PCBs or with mercury.
Would you like some fruit?
Would you like to have a taste of our toxic buffet entirely approved by Health Canada? Some pike fillet, sir, from the St. Lawrence with flame retardants.
It's excellent, huh?
Yeah, they're good.
That's the problem. Mercury, pesticides are tasteless. The fruit is delicious. So good.
Wouldn't you like a little tuna and mercury salad?
Thank you.
Here we have pesticide grapes. Tasty.
Oh, they look wonderful. Oh, I see you have phthalates as well.
Phthalates are everywhere. They come from plastics and vinyl.
They're antibiotics in pork and chicken.
Non-neal phenol garlic butter. What is that?
It sounds toxic, even the name.
I'm starting to get hungry.
Me too, I'm hungry. It looks so appetizing.
We eat that every day. There's nothing else to eat.
But if we don't eat that, what do we eat?
Everything we eat and drink is absorbed by our bodies and transformed into food for our cells. Our cells replace themselves from these substances. Our stomach, our intestines are completely renewed about every 6 months. Our skin, every 28 days. We're a new person every 2 years. Did we think we could get away with polluting everything we're made of? In her intelligence, nature also reminds us of the unity of all living things. Along with the decline of amphibians, we're witnessing the mysterious disappearance of bees. 80% of flowering plants depend on these pollinators. But the insects are dying by the thousands, far from their hives, victims of a weakened immune system or nervous system. And yet, in the same blind race for instant profit, we're introducing transgenic foods and nanoparticles into our environment without really studying the effects they could have on our health. By allowing one acceptable risk after another, we're gradually contaminating all life on this planet. And just as with climate change, no one knows when we will exceed the breaking point.
We're now going to look at the Niger Delta, which has a lot of oil and gas. This is a radio adaptation of a film called Poison Fire, with a website at poisonfire.org. And the fire in question is gas flaring, which is basically disposal of unwanted gas. And the film focuses particularly on efforts to get Shell to stop doing this. Doing a little bit of research, I found a PDF from Shell, which they claimed that there's no evidence of health damage. which pointed to a 15-year-old World Bank report which said the environmental and health impact was low. Nevertheless, they didn't seem fit to comment on the documentary Poison Fire, in spite of repeated efforts to draw it to their attention, so you can draw your own conclusions on that. Some listeners might wonder about the corruption of the Nigerian government, which is reputed to be one of the most corrupt governments in the world. I wonder about the corruption of the UK or the Dutch or the US or other governments which give their cooperation to Shell, which is carrying out this practice, which, quite apart from the fact that it's obviously ecocidal, is known to be illegal. I also turned up the fact that this is a huge greenhouse gas emitter, and I just wondered whether Shell isn't endeavouring to keep this going, because then, under some targeted CO2 emission reduction scheme, they could close this whole operation down, stop burning the gas at the wellhead, maybe they could sell it or use it to generate power or do something else with it, and therefore get huge carbon credits for releasing less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I haven't got a lot of evidence for that thought, it just popped into my mind as the sort of thing that might appeal to these people who seem to have no respect for life or limb, and whose greed, true to their economic model, does appear to be unlimited.
This is the Niger Delta, a vast swamp in Nigeria where the River Niger meets the Atlantic.
We have a belief that the air, water, space here is occupied by the gods. I used to go to the river and meditate most morning, but now you cannot, because gas and oil exploration has driven away these gods so far away.
In 1956, Shell drilled the first oil well in the delta in a village called Oloibiri. Today, Nigeria is the 8th biggest oil exporter in the world.
Israel Aloja, environmental rights action.
I don't think it's anything we can be proud of, because his oil was discovered in the delta, people have known no peace.
A beautiful lush forest with an enormous burning flame in the middle. The city of crude oil, land where the milk and the honey flows. The glory of Nigeria, the pride of Africa. Poison Fire, Gas and Oil Abuse in Nigeria. The fuel you use comes from our area. Should have made Nigeria rich, but if you come to the Niger Delta, you see nothing of that. Especially the environment. We have nowhere to live, no hospitals, we don't have anything. You who watch this, the oil that you use comes from my area, but see our condition. I'm illiterate, I didn't go to school because of school fees.
Ife and Tina are volunteers for Environmental Rights Action, the Nigerian Friends of the Earth. They go around the delta to document the impact of the oil industry on communities.
Since we can't fight, we don't have gun, the only voice we have is this video editing. They say we no sabi book, we don't know book, so we can't write much. But if we are able to do a small film of what is happening to us, slam, it will go to the internet and the whole world will see it.
A wooden boat is punted through beautiful lush rainforest with a sickening and toxic sludge atop the water.
This is crude oil all over the bush and in fact all the surrounding streams and rivers.
There have been 5,000 major oil spills in the delta in 50 years. 1.5 million tons of oil has been discharged into the creeks, farms and forests. That is like one Exxon Valdez disaster every year for 50 years.
Shell
started operation here, and some oil spillages. Fish, crayfish, lobster, crab, up to snake, they died.
And even the snake, the oil has killed all. Small children are dying.
See, the cassava, they don't rot to finish. The oil now is spoiling like this. So. Our plantain, cassava, cocoyam, everything died finished.
All our food, all our fish died finished.
Like our fish ponds that have been damaged, you know that it's a direct effect to us. Mm. Our plants. The loss of livelihood, no compensation. So we just lost total nothing, for nothing. And if you talk, the next thing that's lost, you talk, is military intervention. That is what they do here.
The community asked us to go and do the cleanup.
Me, I was 5 months pregnant.
I miscarried. We are 9 women who miscarried.
Every day, 2 million barrels of oil comes up from thousands of meters down in the earth.
To get to the community, we are benefiting nothing. Nothing.
The oil is mixed with natural gas. The ice formed on this pipe shows that the oil from this particular well contains lots of gas. Then, most of this natural gas is burnt off in gas flares. Why? Because gas is difficult to ship across the Atlantic. The oil companies can pump the oil faster if they don't have to take care of the gas. Wasting it costs them nothing.
When you stand near that gas flare, the heat, there is something in the fire that when it comes out, it stings in the skin. You lose taste, your tongue, you won't even feel your lips. And it itches. Even at night, you can't sleep. You'll be scratching your skin.
Poison fire.
Gas flaring in Nigeria releases as much greenhouse gases as 18 million cars. The waste gas worth billions of dollars per year. It could be used to generate electricity for Africa, or it could be reinjected into the earth and kept there for the future. But they burn it. The delta is densely populated with some 20 million people. Many of the flares are located in village lands, some just a few hundred meters from the houses. The flares cause acid rain that damages crops and soil, and they emit hundreds of different toxic substances that are known to cause respiratory disease and cancer.
This is the hell we've been living with for the past 32 years. We have cases that are associated with lungs, you know, breathing problems, asthmatic patients all over the community. Virtually every food we eat from this community is polluted by gas. We are not saying they should give us money. We are saying that gas flaring has to stop. Whichever means they want to do it, we do not know.
We don't want shit. We don't want shit. We don't want
shit.
People have protested the destruction of their environment since oil drilling began.
Since 1957, a line was there. Their pipeline is still there till now. Shell has not done anything. They should not come this time.
And it is also believed by our people that because these gods are angry, they now possess these boys to fight back. All this kidnapping they are seeing, we attribute it that these boys are possessed by angry gods.
Comrade Che is a retired trade union man and a lifelong social activist and organizer in the Delta.
Violence attracts violence. Peace attracts peace. The oil companies has introduced restiveness and violence in our society. Division, you know, divide and conquer and all that. That there's no more peace. Unlike what we were living, how we were living in our ancient days. That the young lady who is with me here, she is the chairperson of Egi Women Congress. They joined forces with me, international NGOs were coming, they were going around the communities. You were seeing the gas flaring and the damages done by this gas flaring. At a point in time, I realized that the government was disappointing us because they were saying that they want to stop gas flaring 2004, 2006, 2008, oil companies, the NNPC, the government itself. And we come to see that they're not doing it. But since I don't believe in violence, I felt that I should take this matter to court. We mean business and we want justice. We want the gas plants to stop. Not only that, we want the oil companies to stop operation in the Niger Delta.
Yes, sir.
We are not scientists, we are illiterates, and because of our illiteracy and ignorance, they are taking advantage of most of all this.
We are plaintiffs from various oil producing communities in the Niger Delta River State, and we've been to court. We took the major oil companies and the federal government of Nigeria to court concerning the issue of gas flaring. We have an application at the Federal High Court asking them, seeking for a leave to ask them to put an end, an immediate end to gas flaring in our communities. We went there today, and because of the vacation, the case has been adjourned to the 27th of September.
The oil companies don't come to Niger Delta to develop Niger Delta. They are businessmen. They come here to make their profit and go away. So in my own humble opinion, even it's not a question of just saying we should stop gas flaring. I think this is the first step. We want all these oil companies to stop operation. So that, you know, the earth may recycle itself. Because when the wells will dry,
what happens to our land?
Yes. There are many countries in the world that don't produce oil.
Yes.
But they are doing fine.
The case in Port Harcourt did not move forward. But in neighboring Delta State, in a community called Iverikan, there was a parallel case that belonged to the Federal High Court in Benin City. And here, a courageous judge ordered Shell to stop flaring gas immediately.
Iverikan has been a famous place for me for the last 1 year.
Peter Roderick is a lawyer from London.
It is leading the fight in Nigeria to stop gas flaring.
He works for the Climate Justice Program and has helped to raise funds for these cases.
And your community are fighting to stop it and have won the judgment in the court ahead of any other community. And the world, as a result, knows of you and your fight.
Jonah Gebemre, the named plaintiff who brought the case on behalf of the community against Shell, which is being heard in the Nigerian High Court at Benin City.
We are host to Shell. We have a land, 5% of the land acquired by Shell that has Otrogo gas plant. We have about 20 oil wells in the land. And since 1985, when Shell acquired this land, they have been flaring gas to our community. And we have called them many times, talked to them, that this thing is affecting us in numerous ways. It's killing our animals, our aquatic life, our fish.
Yes, it's our land.
Yes, it's our land. But if they see us here, they beat us and shoot at us. We have eye defects now because of the gas flaring. It's very red. Every one of us is very red because of the frequent gas flaring.
The judgment established that gas flaring is illegal in Nigeria. It says Shell's flaring is a gross violation of the people's fundamental right to life and therefore unconstitutional.
Shell are wicked us. They kill us. Kill our land. There's nothing you can plant in the village again no more. We're hungry. Everything is bad.
We are jobless. Everything here. So Shell is a curse for us. We want Shell to leave we alone.